Present today, we have Representative Lancaster, Hudson, Foster, Co-Chairman Williams, myself, Mulder, and Vice Chairman Bundy. We're also joined by Speaker Porter. The purpose of today's meeting is continuing on performance measures with the court, Department of Transportation, and law. Are there any issues to come to the committee before we begin this afternoon's discussion? If not, recognizing the fact that every day we've attempted to get three departments in, and recognizing that every day we've exceeded our time by about an hour to an hour and a half, I will request each department to try and hit not all their performance measures, but the highlights of their performance measures, and hopefully they'll be more successful than the Department of Corrections yesterday. With that, Chris, Stephanie.
I'm forewarned. Thank you, Chairman Mulder. I'm Stephanie Cole. I'm the director of the court system. I've been the director for about 5 years now. And with me today is Chris Christensen, deputy director of the court system, I think well known to most of you. I did provide a handout today, and it's not material that I'm going to go over in any detail, but if I could just point out what is in this packet in case you have any questions about it. The first page is just a statement of what our, this is what it looks like. The first page is a statement of what our mission is, a description of our customers, and a listing of the 8 accepted purposes of courts. The second page is just a map of all the locations around Alaska that we serve. The third page has some basic information about the court system. The fourth page indicates our FY 2002 budget and what we are spending that money on. The fifth page is just provided for your information. It is the funds that we collected last fiscal year on behalf of cities and boroughs. You may recall that if a person is charged with a violation or a misdemeanor, and that charge stems from a municipal ordinance, when that person is fined or has a forfeiture, that money goes back to the affected municipality. So this is money that we collected and channeled back to those entities. The next page is a listing of the permanent fund dividends we processed as of FY01. These are primarily private parties and civil actions who are owed money and make collection through the execution process with the court. Page 7 is just a listing of revenues collected by the court and deposited to various state entities. As you know, generating revenue is not one of our prime functions, but as you can see here, that we do in fact collect a fair amount of revenue that is rechanneled back to the state. And the next 5 pages are a listing of our budget request increments, budget increments requested for FY03. The Alaska court system is the main institution within the judicial branch of government, along with the Judicial Council and the Commission on Judicial Conduct. I think you know that we're relatively tiny. We're only 1.2% of the total state budget, and our budget's heavily weighted towards personal services. Over 76% of our budget pays for employee salaries and benefits. And most of our employees, I'd like to note, are clerical-level employees under range. We have facilities in 46 locations statewide, and we regularly serve an additional 16 communities through traveling services. Our largest locations in terms of employees are Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, Palmer, and Kenai. Because we're a separate branch of government, we operate a little bit like a mini-executive branch, not unlike you do, in that we handle our own support services, such as procurements, human resources, facilities, and computer systems. Our primary business is, of course, dispute resolution. And last year, 155,300 new cases were filed in our trial courts, which is about a 1.2% increase from last year. This is not a hearing about caseload changes, so I won't go into that. There aren't any big dramatic changes in our caseload. The one thing I might note is that we continue to see very significant increases in the caseload in the Palmer Court. That is probably directly attributable to just the growth in that area over the last 10 years. It's not just a problem for Palmer, though. It's a problem for the whole system, since we're having to take resources from Anchorage and feed them into Palmer to support the caseload needs there. So it has repercussions beyond the Palmer Court. That court is in need of both judicial and non-judicial resources. Turning specifically to measures, because I know that's what you're interested in, you will recall that the legislature didn't adopt specific missions and measures for the court system when it adopted them for the executive branch some years ago. And this was for two reasons. First of all, under our constitutional system, the administration of the judicial branch is given to the Supreme Court. And so the legislature believed that the Supreme Court should adopt missions and measures appropriate to the judicial branch. Secondly, again, unlike the executive branch, We already have a number of unique measures for gauging the performance of the court system that stems from Constitution and state law. So I'd like to discuss some of those. Being that our prime function is to resolve disputes, and those disputes are presented to us in the forms of cases filed, we don't have any control over the type of cases that come in or the number of cases that come in. We're in a position of just receiving those cases and responding to them. So when you look at the court's work, the most common measure that people use to assess court performance are time-related measures. This is for two reasons. First of all, because timeliness is extremely important. Disputes need to be resolved in a timely manner. They need to be resolved that way both for the benefit of the litigants and for the benefit of society as a whole. But also timeliness, quite frankly, is a measure that's quantifiable. It's probably one of the easier things to measure where other aspects of the justice system are much more difficult to quantify and measure. So I'd like to talk with you about several aspects of timeliness today. First of all, I reported, I think, last year that in February of 2000, the Supreme Court adopted time standards for trial courts in Alaska. And what a time standard is the Supreme Court went in and looked at different kinds of cases and tried to answer the question, how long should this type of case take from beginning to end? The standards acknowledge that one size doesn't fit all. They're couched in terms of 75th percentile, 90th percentile, and 98th percentile, because there are always going to be some cases that are extraordinarily complex or have such unique circumstances that they are going to take longer and be outside the norm. After the time standards were adopted as an initial step in this process, the court undertook a number of case management improvement efforts to make sure that we were doing things as expeditiously as we could. For example, at judicial conferences, we presented training to judges about methods that successful judges use to monitor and expedite cases in the face of common obstacles. We are also looking at particular types of cases and seeing if court procedures have impediments that can be removed to make cases move faster. For example, we just looked at forcible entry and detainer cases to figure out whether we can eliminate procedures that are time-consuming and maybe not essential. However, I can't tell you today where we stand with regard to meeting the time standards, because I don't currently have the ability to collect the information about our cases to compare with these time standards. You've heard this from us before, that we have an antiquated computer system that collects only minimal information about our caseload, and it doesn't do that well. It doesn't collect the data that we need to determine if our cases are meeting these time standards at this point in time. For example, in felony cases, it doesn't collect the key milestone upon which the felony standards are based, which is the date of judgment. Fortunately, this is only temporary. You, in the last 2 years, appropriated funds to us to purchase a new case management system, and we've just entered into that contract with a vendor who's done this with, I think, 125 other courts nationwide. We're working with that vendor right now to tailor the vendor's system to meet our specific needs, and I'm expecting and hoping that the new system will be functional statewide within 2 years. At that point, we should be able to generate statistical information that is both meaningful to you and also will be able to tell us how we're doing, if our efforts are having some success. So though it is difficult to quantify the time standards efforts at this point, I do believe it's having results. One small indication of this is, as I told you, 1.2% more cases were filed this year than last year. Well, 2.7 more cases were disposed of this year than last year. So we are, it appears, disposing of more cases that are coming in the system, so that at least is good news. In a similar vein, last year you passed SB 172 that was amended Alaska Statute 222310, and that required me to make available to you several categories of information, and this is a quote from the statute. You asked for the average, mean, minimum, and maximum time periods between the initial receipt and final disposition of cases classified by courts and by each justice, judge, and magistrate. And this, again, is an effort to collect information about how long cases are taking. As required, we will submit the information that we have by March 15th, but I have to tell you that it's not going to be very useful for analysis purposes for the same reason I just explained. It can't differentiate between the time attributable to the actions or inactions of a court and the time periods that are completely outside the control of the court, because the data just isn't gathered. There are, for example, there are reasons why cases might be stayed that's made inactive for very long periods of time, for years. And, for example, for federal bankruptcy proceedings or outstanding bench warrants. But our system doesn't flag that, so we can't take that out of the produce a report that takes that into account. And the error rate in the system is extraordinarily high because it's unsophisticated and it requires multiple entries and it doesn't provide safeguards against the entry of incorrect information. But although this is not good news, there is good news that the new system should be able to provide this information. Our efforts haven't been limited to the trial courts, though. The appellate courts have always also been paying attention to timeliness. And because the appellate courts operate on a different and more comprehensive computer system, I can actually report some results with regard to their efforts. Last year, the Supreme Court adopted appellate time standards for the time after submission of civil appeals to the court until decision. That is, from the time that a case comes to the court and is ready for the court to do something until the time that the case is decided. Subsequently, the court started examining their procedures and changing their procedures in an attempt to meet these standards. I just received from the clerk of the appellate court statistics compiled on cases decided last year, which indicate that the court is very close to meeting its new time standards in all civil cases and has beating those standards in expedited appeals. Now the court is going to focus on the appellate court is going to focus on the second part, the pre-submission period before the case is right for the court to decide, and additional proposals are expected to be submitted by late 2002. Our most concrete time measurement exists in criminal cases. As you know, in Alaska, under the Alaska Constitution, in criminal prosecutions, the accused has the right to a speedy trial. And through court rule and case law, this means that with very limited exceptions, a defendant with a felony, a misdemeanor, or a violation has the right to be brought to trial within 120 days. So it's very specific. Of the 155,300 cases filed last year, 113,771 were subject to the speedy trial rule, which meant that 73% of the total filings caseload had to be managed in a way that ensured that a judge in a courtroom would be available for trial within 120 days if the defendant wished. And the penalty for failure to comply with the speedy trial rule is dismissal of the case. Our review of last year's statistics indicate that during the last fiscal year, when 32,276 misdemeanors and felonies were filed in the courts, two felonies and two misdemeanors were dismissed because of speedy trial violations. Now, our goal is certainly zero dismissals because we don't want any cases to be lost because of failure to meet the time standard here. But nevertheless, given the numbers involved, you can see that these four cases represent a small fraction of a single percent of the total cases handled by the court during the year. Finally, I'll mention a statutory timeliness measure that relates to judicial officers. Every justice, judge, and magistrate must submit an affidavit to the Department of Administration each pay period, twice a month, swearing that no matter referred to the judicial officer for opinion or decision has been uncompleted or undecided for more than 6 months. And if the judicial officer can't complete the affidavit, his or her paycheck is withheld until such time as the matter under advisement is resolved. There are about 20,000 or over 20,000 state employees in Alaska. The judicial officers are the only ones that are not paid unless they meet a statutory performance standard. I'm pleased to report that according to our records, there were only 9 instances in FY01 where a judge's paycheck was withheld because the judge did not meet the 6-month requirement. So this was accomplished even though the caseload, in fact, is increasing. I know that today's hearing is primarily measures and missions and measures, but I'd like to, if I could, touch very briefly on 3 budget matters that may be of interest to you. First of all, if you can see on page, focusing on our budget request for next year, you can see on page 11 of our handout that we have a request in this year for second year funding for HB 172. Last year, you approved funding for DWI court projects in Anchorage and Bethel, but the funding approved last year only covered 9 months of Anchorage expenses and 6 months of Bethel expenses. So the additional amount here, $146,100, represents the remaining amount required to fully fund those projects. Secondly, you'll see that our budget request includes $680,200 to compensate for the increase in the judicial retirement rate assessed against the court system. The JRS rate is reassessed every 2 years, unlike the PERS system, which is reassessed every year. And after two periods of significant decreases, we're now seeing a rate increase from 17.07% to 28.20%, primarily because of member demographics, and they're using a newer mortality table. So in prior years, when the rate decreased, we advised you of the windfall we would have received so that you would have it available to appropriate as you saw fit. Now we're in the reverse situation, and we're requesting funding to meet this non-negotiable cost, which is completely outside of our control. As the last thing I wanted to mention to you in my remarks is I wanted to make a brief statement about court security measures. After September 11th, we all have heightened sensitivity to the vulnerability of the security of our facilities and institutions. We've included in our budget again this year, both in the capital and the operating sides, funds to make our courthouses more secure. In fact, the way that our government system is structured here, the responsibility for providing courthouse security is with the Department of Public Safety. But the department is currently funded at a level that does not allow it to provide the level of courthouse security it knows is warranted. Security is expensive, and the cost of associated with providing security are not costs that lend themselves easily to a cost-benefit analysis. However, there is absolutely no question that we are not providing adequate security at our courthouses, at most of our courthouses, for judges, for court staff, for litigants, and for jurors. Court employees regularly report to me situations in which they fear for their safety, situations in which they're dealing with people who have not been screened before they enter the court facility, and situations where they have no security personnel to assist them. Our customers are often very unhappy and very unstressed, very stressed, and are not always behaving well. Judge Weeks, right here in Juneau, in the last 2 weeks, sent me some stories with regard to recent court cases that clearly indicate circumstances in which a reasonable person could feel threatened. And yet we have no screening devices in the Juneau court and an inadequate number of judicial services personnel. I do ask that you consider funding at least part of the Department of Public Safety's request for courthouse security services this year, even if the entire request can't be funded. Thank you.
Are there any questions for Stephanie or Chris? Representative Bundy.
A little further information for me, if I might, on the channeling back of fines that the court assesses. We have areas in the state where the state's required to basically try all the cases for a municipality. Does the court take an administrative fee out? Is there any way that the expense of the court could help defrayed by these monies that are then channeled back to the municipality?
Through the chair, Representative Bundy, there are a number of fees associated with these collections, but I don't believe that any fee is assessed against the recipients, any percentage fee or service fee. Do you remember differently, Chris?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bundy, there used to be a law on the books which required the court system to collect money from the municipalities when the municipalities utilized court services, and it was a fairly vague law. It actually required a calculation of overhead and everything else. And the legislature repealed this, I believe, in the late 70s, early 80s, when the state was at its richest. We had a great deal of trouble collecting the money at that time. In fact, we once had to initiate a legal action against the municipality of Anchorage because they were not providing the money. This could be done, but it would have to be done by statute. And if it were done by statute, it probably should be done in a way different than the way it used to be. It could be drafted so that it was much more clear.
If I might.
Certainly.
Yeah, you assess court costs in civil action, but in criminal action, you're not able to assess court costs. Is that the bottom line?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think that we actually assess costs really for the actual for the use of the judge, the use of the jury, the use of the courtroom in either civil or criminal cases.
Okay, thank you.
Chris, how many resources are required? How many resources are dedicated toward the actual collection of fines that are then given back to either agencies and/or other municipalities? Is it a costly and time-consuming process?
Mr. Chairman, I could do a little bit of investigation. We have a fairly small accounting department. We're not top-heavy in those people.
I thought it was a fairly efficient, and that was why process, and that's why it was given to you as opposed to somewhere else, because it is fairly immediate, it's fairly cost-conscious, and it's the entity, even though you are not in the collections business, you are the closest to the activity. As the judge is meting out the sentence, you are there at the backside, so to speak. Go pass go. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question I have surrounds the request of $1.5 million for 3% salary increases. Has the court system essentially followed the same increments that the administrative side of government has had for the last 2 to 3 years, which I think was 2% or 1.5% or 2%, something like that? So essentially, you've followed that. And do you go into any kind of negotiations, or is this an arbitrary request? How do you handle that?
Through the chair. Representative Hudson, we are not unionized. We are non-covered employees in the state of Alaska, so we don't enter into the type of negotiations you would with a labor union, if that is your question. We are part of the unorganized state employees.
So the 3% is based on what cost of living increases, in your judgment?
Through the chair.
Money needed in order to retain people, I mean, some justification for it.
Oh, there's certainly that justification. I think that's the same justification that has been used for all departments and state employees went a very long time without much in the way of increases. If I might just add to that, I would say, from our perspective, it is becoming increasingly difficult to hire and retain court employees. It used to be considered a pretty darn good job, but these days that we are finding very, very difficult to do with our current pay and benefits. So I think it is absolutely essential to keeping court employees and other state employees anywhere near parity.
It would apply equally to all of the employees of the court as well as the judges and other officers?
The chair, yes, that's correct.
Any other questions for Stephanie or Chris? Representative Lancaster.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe just to follow on that a little bit, what do you use for a comparison or a benchmark to come up with your 3% then?
Through the chair. Actually, the 3% for the last 3 years, that was all part of a negotiation. Essentially, we were in the back seat on that. That was something negotiated through the Department of Administration and presented to you entirely as a package. This is the first year that we're presenting this separately, but we didn't go into separate calculations for that. We simply carried on with the whole.
Any further questions? We will anxiously await the outcome of your new computer system and some performance measures. Thank you. I don't see the Department of Transportation.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
I'm Larry Cohn, the head of the Judicial Council. I advise I have a few minutes to address the committee. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, as I mentioned, I am the new head of the Alaska Judicial Council, which is a separate entity from the court system. I've been in my current position since October, and like everyone else, I've been advised that I have a very brief opportunity to address you today. And so I would invite you, and I look forward to discussing with you in greater detail any of the topics that I discussed today at some future point. I also disseminated a handout. The first page of the handout is intended to track my remarks today. The remaining documents in the handout are materials that I culled from our budget packet that appear to be more relevant to the missions and measures type of information that you're seeking today. The Alaska Judicial Council has constitutional and statutory duties in three general areas. First, the council screens applicants for judicial vacancies and nominates the most qualified applicants for appointment by the governor. The legislature's also assigned the council the task of screening applicants for the public defender agency, the head of the public defender agency, and for administrative tax law judges. The second duty of the council is to evaluate the performance of judges who appear on the ballot and to make that performance information available to the public. And we're to make recommendations as to whether we believe the judge ought to be retained or not. The Supreme Court has asked the council to conduct similar evaluations of pro tem judges and masters and magistrates. And the legislature has required the council to evaluate the performance of administrative tax law judges. The third area of responsibility imposed by the Alaska Constitution directs the Alaska Judicial Council to conduct studies and make recommendations to improve the administration of justice in Alaska. The legislature has assigned the council various tasks over the years. For example, we were recently assigned the task of collecting civil case data on civil cases, and another time assigned the task of reviewing information pertinent to the use of DNA evidence in criminal cases. Our budget falls into two categories, our proposed budget for FY03. The first part and principal part of our budget is simply a continuation budget at the same level as our FY02 authorized budget. Actually, this is approximately $39,000 less than we received last year. The continuation budget is $750,000. $39,000 less because it doesn't include approximately $39,000 in a one-time carryover that the legislature permitted for the council to complete its comprehensive criminal justice process study. The second part of our budget involves two increments. The first increment in an amount of approximately $16,000 is to fund the third year of a state labor contract. And we've also proposed a new study of pro se litigation, which represents an increment of about $42,000. Our budget also includes a continuation of a $30,000 pass-through grant to the CourtWatch program, which is sponsored by Victims for Justice. CourtWatch sends volunteers to observe criminal court proceedings and provides that information to the council, and we use it as one measure of judicial performance. I'd like to briefly touch on the tasks that we accomplished in the past year and what we anticipate for the coming year. As I mentioned, the Constitution and statutes require us to evaluate candidates for judicial positions. For each position, we conduct a very comprehensive survey of members of the Bar Association. We obtain reference letters and performance estimates by professionals who've had direct recent experience with the applicant. We review the applicant's discipline, credit history, and criminal history, and any prior applications by the applicant. We also conduct a public hearing and solicit public input and also interview the applicant. In the last year, the council has nominated applicants for five judicial vacancies, four Superior Court vacancies and one District Court vacancy. Three out of the four Superior Court vacancies are in Anchorage. The other one is in Bethel. The council recently met and nominated candidates for the Bethel position and both the Anchorage position, which are new courts created by the House in HB 172 last year, intended to be therapeutic courts. Our selection activity in the past year is comparable to what I've been told is average. On an average year, the council expects to screen between 50 and 80 applicants for six judicial positions. The nomination of Judge Beislein to the federal bench is likely to create a vacancy on the Fairbanks Superior Court, but other specific vacancies are a little bit more difficult to anticipate. And with regard to our activities in judicial retention, we're required by the Constitution and statutes to evaluate judges who stand for retention. 2002 is a retention election year. 17 judges will be on the ballot this fall, including one Supreme Court Justice, one Court of Appeals judge, six Superior Court judges, and nine District Court judges. We send surveys to all peace and probation officers, to all members of the Bar Association, to all social workers, to guardians ad litem, and other volunteers that work with children, all court employees and jurors that served on cases in the preceding 2 years involving that judge. In all, we survey approximately 10,000 Alaskans. We also analyze appellate affirmance and reversal rates, compile records on peremptory challenges, review discipline, credit, and criminal histories, conflict of interest filings. We encourage all forms of public comment. We make our information widely available. It's included, as you know, as a page in the election pamphlet that's disseminated to every household in Alaska. As part of our responsibility to pursue a high level of judicial performance, we've also, pursuant to requests by the Supreme Court, conducted evaluations. We will conduct an evaluation of judges who will stand for retention in 2004. That is 17 judges, and we also conduct surveys of peace and probation officers and members of the bar with respect to those judges, with the point being to improve judicial performance. The Supreme Court's asked us to evaluate the performance of standing masters and magistrates in Alaska. As you know, masters have a heavy caseload in family law and domestic violence matters. Magistrates in many rural locations are the sole judicial officer. We've just completed a masters and magistrate survey, which we've shared with the masters and magistrates and the presiding judges, their supervisors, with a view towards improving their performance. We're also obligated by court rule to evaluate pro tem, retired pro tem judges, and we do that in the case of about 4 to 6 judges a year. The third area of our responsibility involves research, and I'd simply like to make the point that our research is not just for academic reasons. We conduct research that's actually used by state agencies, by the public in general. Our research is aimed at improving the quality of justice, but and not only that, but to make the administration of justice more cost-effective. I mentioned the Criminal Justice Process Study, the Supreme Court's Advisory Committee on Fairness and Access, and the Criminal Justice Assessment Commission recommended that the council study felony cases from arrest through sentencing. The idea was to focus on the reasons for the disproportionate number of minorities in the criminal justice system. We've culled information from more than 2,300 felony cases statewide involving 1999 defendants, and we will issue a report and recommendations by the end of this fiscal year. We'll also, although we'll complete the study by the end of the fiscal year, we intend to use our findings as baseline data for other evaluations that we're doing. We're also heavily involved with the Criminal Justice Council. The Criminal Justice Council was formed to follow up the recommendations of the Alaska Criminal Justice Assessment Commission, which was comprised of members of the three branches of government as well as members of the community, make recommendations as to how to relieve the problem of prison overcrowding in the criminal justice process. We just recently completed an interim report, and we provide staffing for the Criminal Justice Council. Our senior staff associate serves as the council's director. The Criminal Justice Council has provided cost-effectiveness data for the legislature and worked with agencies to reduce prison overcrowding and has coordinated policy with its various members. We intend to continue working in the ensuing fiscal year on implementing the recommendations of the Criminal Justice Assessment Commission. Another area in which we're involved involves the collection of civil case data. As you know, in 1997, as part of tort reform legislation, the statutes were passed that requires us to compile this information on civil case data. We've issued a couple of reports. Our most recent report was issued in May of 2001, and we was based on information that we gathered from nearly 3,000 civil cases. We'll continue to collect and analyze this data in the ensuing year, and we'll publish our findings to the legislature and to the public. We're also charged with evaluating the various therapeutic justice projects which are underway. The projects are intended to reduce recidivism and to reduce the cost of incarceration, law enforcement, prosecution, and all the other costs associated with the criminal process. There's a felony drug court program in Anchorage. There are two new Superior Court judgeships, as I mentioned, created by HB 172 last year. There's a wellness court in the Anchorage District Court, which is focuses on misdemeanants addicted to alcohol, and also the Court Coordinated Resources Project, which identifies and diverts to community-based treatment mentally ill persons who enter the criminal justice system for misdemeanor offenses. We've designed databases in the last year and established research agreements and started to collect data with which to analyze these various therapeutic courts. Our evaluation will continue for 2 to 4 years for these five different therapeutic courts. Just briefly, I mentioned that a few other things that we are involved in. We're involved with the coordination and integration of Alaska's criminal justice computer systems. We also issue a victim's handbook, which we originally issued in 1995. We updated in 1998. We also recently updated it, revised it, and published it 10,000 copies just a few months ago. And every legislator should have received a copy, and we can certainly make more available. We also publish a guide to the criminal justice system, which the legislature requested some years ago that we do. We've revised it a few times and intend to revise it again in the ensuing fiscal year. We're working on establishing an internet bar survey as part of our comprehensive website through which we provide information on our various studies to the public. And the Internet Bar Survey is intended to increase the information we get from the bar with respect to selection and retention, and to reduce the cost of collecting that information. The increment that we've proposed, the pro se study, pro se litigation is an increasingly significant event in Alaska and elsewhere. There are some studies that suggest that 60% to 80% of some kinds of cases involve one or more pro se litigants. I don't have time to go into any great detail about what we propose to do, but much more detail is provided in the materials that I passed out to you earlier today. We're required under the Constitution to make reports and recommendations to the Supreme Court and the legislature every 2 years. And in the coming fiscal year, we will prepare and publish a report which summarizes our activities in the year 2001 and 2002 and provide it to the legislature. We're also involved in a number of committees, in which I don't have time to address, but a couple worthy of mention. We're involved in increasing the public outreach and communication between the public and the court system. We're also involved in improving the judicial education so as to improve the judicial performance. So once again, this is just a very brief abbreviated opportunity for me to tell you what we've been doing and what we expect to do in the coming year, and I welcome the opportunity to discuss any or all of this with each of you at some point in the future.
All right, thank you very much, Larry. Also on teleconference, we have Marla Greenstein. Marla, can you, we have your handout before us, Representative Davies. Larry, before you go.
Oh, sorry.
In your study of recidivism, can you tell us what definition of recidivism you're going to be using?
Well, recidivism, we will measure defendants against every time they have contact with the criminal justice system. And we'll be doing a number of comparisons depending on which context you're talking about. But with respect to, felony sentencing study, more pertinently, with respect to the Therapeutic Justice Project, we will evaluate defendants after they go through the Therapeutic Project, the number of times they have contact with the criminal justice system after they go through the therapeutic process compared to what they did before. We'll also be comparing them to people who didn't participate in the therapeutic projects. With respect to mental health, the mental health court will be comparing people that went through the therapeutic process, the number of contacts with API or admissions at API they've had, and contacts with the criminal justice system as contrasted to with contacts with API and admissions to API and contacts with the criminal justice system prior to going through the process.
The reason I asked the question is we had Commissioner of Corrections in here yesterday, and she was talking about the measure that they're using, and it's actually a three-year measure, and you were talking about this study only going on for 2 to 4 years, and it seemed like, I guess that just seemed like that's a pretty short period of time to get a valid string of data.
Depending on what
your actual definition of recidivism
is. Yes, it is short because you have to wait for the person to complete the therapeutic program, which is a minimum of a year. I mean, they're different for each one. And then you have to have at least a year to study their recidivism after they complete the project. And then you have to cull all these other cases from around the state to compare it. So you're right, it is a short time. We would like to have more time, but it's difficult to project the expense of doing that. And we intend to follow that up if we obtain sufficient funding to do that. It would be a much better study. But at least for now, we're doing what we can. But it's a legitimate concern.
Yeah, I'd be interested to see, you know, if you could construct it in a way at least that we could have the option to continue it so that we don't have to start all over again.
I'd be very much in favor of that.
Yeah.
Larry, Representative Davies, I think the purpose of Larry studying this, you weren't here at the time, Larry, but John, you probably remember the reason that you're studying it at all is the fact that we put performance standards in the bill, therapeutic court bill, to give evaluation of its relative effectiveness, so that when the time comes that the sunset happens on this bill, we can make an informed decision about its whether we should retain it or not, as opposed to simply relying upon pass around word that, oh, this is a great thing, we've got to keep doing it.
Sure.
Which is generally in the past been the way we've evaluated things, as opposed to having concrete information.
Yes, and that's right. We're obligated to do that, and we will do that.
Hard statistics are much better than anecdotal information. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Following my question that I had with the judicial folks that were up here, 3% salary increase, is it negotiated with you folks, or are you exempt as well?
You know, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hudson, I don't know the answer to that. You know, I'm relatively new. I've been advised that this is a done deal, that it's a $16,000 increment that's required by a state labor contract. I don't really know how that came to be, but I can certainly find out.
Okay. And then if you could just, for my education, because I'm not familiar with the senior staff associate, looks like $135,000.
Yes. Well, that's a person,
Governor. I'm just curious as to what he is.
No, it's she, Terry Carnes, and she works 80% time, so she gets less than that. But Terry Carnes has been with the Judicial Council for 27 years, and that accounts for her high salary through the state merit system. She's arrived at that level. I will say that Terry Carnes is one of the most competent persons I've ever met. Because she's been there since the inception, she knows everything the council's ever done, and is sort of an oracle of information and experience that we rely on.
I'm satisfied with that. Thank you.
Any further questions for Larry? Hearing none. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Marla, we have the Commissioner of DOT ready to begin. Do you have any comments? We have your handout. Any brief comments about judicial conduct?
I would like to take just a couple of minutes. I'll be very quick.
All right. Go right ahead.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Marla Greenstein, and I'm the Executive Director for the Judicial Conduct Commission, which, as you are all familiar, is a constitutionally created agency that handles ethics complaints against judicial officers. And since you do have my handout, it spells out kind of the more proactive things we've done in terms of educational efforts. I just wanted to mention a couple of things that we're anticipating in the future and just point out a couple of quick items in our budget. We are the smallest agency and the smallest branch, so we have the smallest budget. And what we spend our funds on is a two-person staff that allows us to run a full-time office so that we can respond to judicial inquiries or advisory ethics opinions and respond to the public in a prompt and efficient manner. And we've met all our internal time measurement standards in that respect. We also adopted new rules that should expedite our process in terms of going formally against judges where we have serious charges that will result in a formal hearing. We've consolidated some of our pre-charging process and also the time frames for our post-charge to hearing process. So those things should happen a little bit more swiftly. Under our old rules, they were becoming a little burdensome, and at times it would take over a year from the time it was charged until we had a hearing. So I just wanted to mention those couple of things. I am very conservative fiscally, so you will see that our actual expenditures for the past several years are in excess of our authorized expenditures, and we've required supplementals. This year, we will also have a very small supplemental request. They're always attributable to attorney's fees in cases that we proceed against, because we do need to hire an attorney on contract on an as-needed basis since we don't have a staff attorney position. And that very small increment, which will, supplemental, which will come through hopefully on the fast track supplemental, just seems to be $6,800, which is a direct result from my underestimating supplemental request that we filed last year and was appropriated for $42,000. The total cost for that litigation exceeded my conservative estimate, so we do owe the attorney at this point $6,800. And that's just because I had to estimate in January what our bills would be as of June 30th. So I apologize for that. In terms of our budget, we have a very small increment for $4,400, which, as with the Judicial Council and the court system, reflects that state salary adjustment. It was my understanding from talking with OMB and coming up with that number to answer some of the previous questions, that because we use the same state salary schedule for all state employees. We have, you know, ranges and steps, just like every other state employee. The schedules get adjusted through negotiations largely with the larger departments in the different branches, and we actually just respond to that. So because we're categorized in these steps and ranges, we need that increase just to match what our obligation is under that administrative grid. I hope that answers that question, and I'd be happy to answer any questions now or individually over the phone or later on.
Are there any questions for Marla? There's none at this time. Thank you, Marla.
Thank you.
I guess Department of Law?
DOT.
DOT.
How were the roads on the way?
Mr. Chairman, my first point, I wanted to see if there's any interest in this group in increasing our snow removal budget.
Not in the city of Juneau.
Good afternoon, Commissioner. It's all yours.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. I'm, I think, as all of you know, Joe Perkins, the Commissioner of the Department of Transportation. I'd like to thank you all for inviting me to present a report on the performance of DOT.
Commissioner, before you start, do you have a handout?
Yeah.
I have a handout, Mr. Chairman, standards? Which I was going to pass out at the end.
Oh, you're going to force us to pay attention.
Yes, sir. And if I could ask the chairman if we could hold questions till I've got 45 performance measures to go through.
What I was going to suggest, Commissioner, if you'd like to hit the highlights, that'd probably be in your interest and our interest in terms of maximizing the time.
Okay. You know, there's, as I said here last year, there's various ways, I think, that you can determine how well an agency's performing. And today, I'd like to go over a few of those ways with you. First, a look at some of the department's accomplishments, which I consider to be major. Second, a review of the awards received by the department and its members. And finally, a discussion of the performance measures, of which we have 45 of them. As I'm sure you're probably aware, the department's mission is to develop, operate, maintain, and manage facilities, vehicles, and transportation modes. We're responsible for over 6,000 centerline miles of roads, 715 bridges, 260 airports, plus two international airports, 600 buildings, 79 harbors, 9 ferries, and over 7,600 pieces of other equipment. I'd like to first talk a little bit about a few of our major accomplishments that I think you should be aware of before we go further. First, this past year, we were able to award the construction contract for C Concourse at the Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport, hyphen within budget. So we do not need any more money for the work on Concourse C. We recently awarded the contract for the design and construction of our first two fast vehicle ferries to implement the Southeast Alaska Transportation Plan. And finally, with a great deal of assistance from the Department of Law, we reached a settlement on the $46 million Kennicott claim, ferry claim, that cost the state $500,000, which I think was a very, very good settlement. We've also had many challenges, including the homeland security issues. Not many people know, but we were the first state to get its airports back online after September the 11th. I think on the whole we've had a good year and there's been some major accomplishments. How are we doing in compared to our peers in other states? I believe that is an excellent means of determining our performance, how we score against other DOTs. The Nationwide Road Information Program rated Alaska roads at 60% in good or fair condition, 34% in mediocre condition, and 6% in poor condition. The national average is 68% in good or fair, 21% in mediocre, and 11% in poor. Considering the extreme weather
and harsh physical conditions which we deal with in Alaska, such as permafrost, thermal cracking, wetlands, I think we stack up pretty well with the other states. However, we need to concentrate on our mediocre roads and move a larger percentage of those into the good category. And we can do this mainly by repaving roads. For those of you who want to travel in Lower 48 by car, Georgia has the best rated roads in the nation, followed by Alabama, Florida, Wyoming, and Kansas. The worst in the nation are California, Massachusetts, Missouri, Connecticut, and Louisiana. We're about in the middle, which I think is pretty good. Over the past year, many national awards have been bestowed upon DOT employees and projects, and I'd like to tell you about a few of them. After receiving 7 awards in year 2000, the Whittier Tunnel received an additional award last year. The prestigious American Society of Civil Engineers 2001 Outstanding Civil Engineering Accomplishment Award. We beat out the new Dome Stadium in Houston, Texas for that award, and it is only the 4th time in the history of that award, which goes back 50 or 60 years, that a highway project has ever been given that award. So we have done quite well. Other awards have included Tom Moses, our project manager for the Whittier Tunnel, received the ASHTO President's Award for Highways and the Western Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials WASHTO Hughes Award. These are national and western states award for the top, the number one highway engineer in this nation. And that is, again, I think quite an accomplishment. Among the team awards received, which really means something to me, was the Southeast region received the ASHTO Team Recognition Award for the repatriation of bodies interred in Sitka. This was called the Journey Back Home, and we received the Exemplary Partner Award. On a personal note, I completed my term as president of the 18 States Western Association of State Highway Officials, and I'm into my 3rd year as the chairman of the ASHTO Standing Committee on Highways, which, among other things, sets the standards for all of the highways in the United States. I also am one of 2 official U.S. representatives to an organization called PEARC, which is the World Road Council, which includes 60 other countries. The Alaska DOT will be hosting the ASHTO annual meeting in Anchorage of all the 50 states this October 11th to 16th. We expect up to 2,000 attendees, including all the DOT commissioners or secretaries or whatever they call them, from the 50 states, numerous federal officials, including the Secretary of Transportation. First time it's ever been held in Alaska. We competed for this and won it. And I think it's an opportunity to excel, and I'm sure Alaska will excel in this endeavor. I'm really proud, and I think Alaska should be proud of what the department's professional staff has accomplished. The Alaska DOT has earned and is recognized nationally as one of the transportation leaders in the United States. I'd like to now go start through the performance measures. The first performance measure was a percentage of divisions that reached assigned performance measures, and all of our divisions are tracking the assigned performance measures. Some of these measures take over a year to do, but I think we're making good progress on them. Secondly, the percent of state national highway system lane miles of road that meet the standard of the American of ASHTO. We've made a concentrated effort to modernize the national highway system routes in Alaska. There are now 1,487 miles of the national highway system that meet national standards compared to 1,424 last year. This is a gain of 63 miles. 615 miles are remaining that do not meet the standards. Of these, approximately 300 plus are on the Dalton Highway. We've made significant progress on the Seward, Glenn, Parks, Dalton, and other major highways, which improves our national highway systems for citizens and commerce while adding to safety. 3, the percentage of requested engineering firm audits and desk reviews completed in the previous fiscal year. During fiscal year 2001, internal review received requests for and completed 51 audits. This compares to 50 last year. These people continue to do a great job. 4, the percentage of required compliance review for responsiveness to disadvantaged business enterprise and on-the-job training contract requirements completed. 140% of our required compliance reviews were completed by the Civil Rights Office. This was the total we had to do was 10. We did 14 total reviews. These folks have done an outstanding job, and this, of course, is an exacting federal requirement that we do these. Five, the average time taken to respond to complaints and questions that have been elevated to the commissioner's office. The average time is approximately 3 weeks. However, sometimes if the matter is really complex and we are short staffed or something, it'll take us a little longer. But we are shooting for 3 weeks, and we're pretty well tracking with a 3 week response time. I would like to reduce that in the future if we can, and we're going to try. Six, whether the average time for payment to vendors is 29 days or less. Over the past 3 years, the department has maintained an average of 24 days for payment to vendors. Through the first quarter of FY02, the department is continuing to maintain this 24-day average for payments. And when you take the amount of money that we run through DOT, this is an important thing in this state. And I can tell you, among the contracting community, they love the state and DOT for this 24-day payment because they don't get it in most other places that contractors deal with. How long it takes a division to process a purchase request before the order is placed. We converted to an automated purchasing system in January of 2001. The only information that I have is on this is for those small procurements under $50,000. I'll have a full year's data on all of them for you next year. But since we've converted to that system, we've identified somewhere around 5 days as the time it takes for us to process it. I think we're speeding up this process, and this automated system, I believe, is the answer. The percentage of protests and claims appealed to the commissioner that courts overturned during the fiscal year. I guess this measure tells us how well our construction claims process works and how many times the commissioner's right. We had 4 DOT construction-related appeals from prior years in the Superior Court at the beginning of 2001. One was settled in favor of the court. Another was ruled in favor of DOT by the Superior Court, but has been appealed to the Supreme Court, and the last two are still active in Superior Court. During the year, there were 6 new appeals filed with me, and to date, none of my decisions this last year have been appealed to the courts. 9, the percentage reduction in payroll calculation errors. We are down to an error rate of 1.9% based on errors per number of payroll warrants issued. Of that rate, a little over a percent, we feel is related to avoidable errors, and we're going to work on that 1% and see if we can. But that's pretty good. That's a pretty low number for the amount of people that we end up paying. Number 10, the number and dollar value of planned projects that are constructed as a percentage of the value of projects on the needs list and the number proposed. About $500 million in projects are constructed each year, and that's about 6.6% of our estimated $7.5 billion needs list. And this needs list, of course, is the list of projects that's been defined by us, boroughs, and local communities. I don't see that we can do much to whittle that list down any faster because it depends on how much money we get as we do projects. 11, the percentage of required federal planning, programming, and data collection completed and accepted by the United States Department of Transportation on a federal fiscal year basis. We're in 100% compliance with this. The state has never lost one nickel due to a failure to meet transportation data collection requirements. The number of motor vehicle crashes during the fiscal year at which serious injury or fatality occurred. In 1999, there were 79 fatal motor vehicle crashes in the state. That figure has risen to 103 in 2000. And this, of course, gives some concern to both myself and Glenn Godfrey. To give you a comparison of where we stand in Alaska, the national average of fatal accidents per 1 million miles, per 100 million miles traveled in the year 2000, national average is 1.6. Alaska's average is 2.2. We need to lower this accident rate, and we're going to be working toward that in great detail and developing more safety programs aimed at reducing fatalities. I do not have the 201 numbers because they're still being brought in by some of the boroughs, communities, and so on. But I certainly do not like to see these traffic deaths go up in this state. 13, the percentage of federal highway funds obligated in the previous federal fiscal year, and my answer is the same it's been for the last 8 years, 100%. We have yet to, at least in the 10 years that I am privy to, turn back one penny to the federal government. In fact, this year we received an additional $2.2 million from the feds, which was money that could not be spent by other states. We got $1.5 million last year, so we got a little more this year than we did last year. The percentage of projects in the capital project and the capital budget that have been bid in the year programmed, and we're running somewhere around 95% of the projects in the STIP program are bid in the year program. The 5% that aren't bid are projects which are deliberately included in the program in the event that extra federal funds are appropriated so we can go with those projects. 15, the percentage of total project cost spent on project development. And last year it was 14%, this year it's 14.4%. Little increase, but nothing really, I think, that gives me concern. The percent difference between final project estimate and construction bids, we are developing a program to track that. It's a little hard to track, and this program is about 50% complete. This next year we'll give you a detailed report, but the ones I've observed here recently, we have been very, very close to the dollars that the bids are coming in. 17, whether the department is successful in requiring private contractors performing design and engineering services for the state to report the same measures. And we are doing that, and they're already included in the results that I'm reporting for the other measures. Percentage of design and construction that's performed by private contractors, we're running slightly in excess of 50% by private contractors, which is about where we want to be. The National Transportation Resource Board, which has probably got the best information on this, recommends about 50%, so I think we're in pretty good shape. 19, the percentage of total construction costs that were spent on contract administration. In FY00, Central had 18, Northern 18, and Southeast Region had 19. That was last year. We've reduced that to 14.6 in Central, 3.4% reduction, down to 14.7 in Northern, which is about a 3.3% reduction, and all the way down to 12.5% in Southeast Region. So we've averaged reduced somewhere around 5% in the amount of contract admin cost charged against projects. I'm happy with that number. The percentage of the total construction costs that were spent on change orders. Now, this is another, I think, very good measure. I'll do it by region. Central region last year was 6. This year they're 5.7. Northern region was 6. They're 6.3 this year. Last year, Southeast region was 8. They're down to 5.8 this year. So we're running somewhere around 6% of our construction costs and change orders, and that is well within the industry norm for construction work. 21, whether the net value of facilities deferred maintenance increases or decreases annually. I think you all know the answer to this one. We're up to $55.5 million in deferred maintenance on our facilities. It increased pretty much this year because DOT has condemned and moved out of three facilities, three of our maintenance facilities, which were in imminent danger of collapsing. You all gave us money last year to run a structural analysis of our facilities after we had two collapses, one at Cascade Camp and one at the camp on the Dalton, just across the Yukon River. Luckily, we had nobody hurt in those total collapses. Well, so far we've found three of our buildings are in imminent danger of collapsing. These are Chandelier on the Dalton Highway, East Fork on the Parks Highway, and the facility at Willow on the Parks Highway. And we have vacated those buildings and are using temporary places. I think there's one more about to come up to fail, which is going to be the Nome facility also, and we're probably going to be moving out of it very, very shortly. The percentage of facility mechanical systems that pass safety inspection each year, we've been sitting at 95%. We remain at 95%. We can't gain that last 5% because it's capital work. And these projects to pick up that last 5% are in that deferred maintenance number that I gave you. The percentage of rural airport leases that are renewed or newly leased at fair market value during the fiscal year. We really can't do anything about that until we adopt new Title 17 regulations, which I will commit to you will be within the next 2 months. When those new regulations are published, we are slowly but surely going to increase our rates much closer to fair market value. The report you get next year should show some results as Title 17, the changes to Title 17 kick in. Transfer of state-owned ports and harbors to local control. Y'all, last year authorized or gave us money for Ketchikan Bar Harbor South, Pelican Harbor, and partial funding for the transfer of the Sitka facility. As of this month, Pelican Harbor and Sitka have been transferred, and Ketchikan is just waiting, I think, a final vote from the Assembly and will be transferring soon. To date, due to your programs, 22 facilities have been transferred. We got 31 ready and waiting to be transferred. The cost for transferring these remaining 31 harbors is estimated at approximately $38 million. 25, whether 80% of the fleet wet rentals are returned to the division as scheduled for preventive maintenance on or before June 30th of the fiscal year. As of October, the statewide average was 85%, which exceeds the 80% in the performance measure. The average downtime for light-duty, actively used equipment in urban areas. The first full year of data in 01 showed a statewide average of 7.3%, which isn't too bad. 27, the number of locations of the state equipment fleet whose rates are equal to or less than the rental rate published in industry guidebooks. We've completed a comparison of the FY201 rental rates with the current rental rate blue book, a total of 1,478 vehicles and 162 regional rate classes were included in the study. What we found out that we were below blue book in all cases except two. In fact, we were at an average this year of 34% of blue book. This was the percentage I reported to you last year was 39, so we've come down 5%. Those two instances I referred to were for high maintenance one ton pickups on the Dalton Highway, and the second one was for central region's mower booms that we operate off of backhoes. Actually, you know, this performance measure really had us look at this because we're going to correct this, and what we found out is the reason we have them the rental rate so high is that we're spending too much money on maintenance because it's old equipment. We need to replace it sooner. So we will be replacing that equipment sooner, and this performance measure really is responsible for identifying this, and it'll end up saving us in the long run. 28, commercial vehicle safety inspections per full-time equivalent employee of the division. 201 performance was 278 inspections per full-time equivalent employee compared to 165 in last year. Total inspections in FY01 was 5830. Our commercial vehicle people are doing a great job, and this is a very important activity because what this is taking off the road are getting fixed are trucks. We're getting brakes cleaned up, we're getting a lot of things cleaned up, and these people go fairly unnoticed in the overall state business, but I can tell you, I feel a heck of a lot better driving out there and passing a truck, and I know that we've got an active safety program to ensure that most of them are in good shape. 29 weighing and measuring devices inspected per full-time equivalent. We went down slightly on those. In 01, we inspected 11,372. This includes grocery scales and everything else. And that was 1,400 inspections per full-time equivalent. Last year, we had 1,700 and some. And the reason we went down is because we've had a pretty dramatic turnover in staff, and we had to train new staff, and so they lost days of inspection. We'll be back up to 1,600 of these next year with the inspectors that we've got on board. 30, the number of miles of gravel road that are surfaced with chip seal, hot mix, or high fluid asphalt for the first time reported regionally. Central region did 72 miles of road, northern region 244.4, and southeast region 15. There are now 331.4 miles of highway in Alaska that we have converted from gravel to asphalt this last year. I think we're making great progress in getting this state paved. 31, the percentage of highway and airport lane miles per full-time equivalent compared to the average of member states of the west of the WASHTO, Western Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials. Northern region, and these are some pretty interesting comparisons, and let me give you first, 15 of the 18 western states that we polled, averaged together, maintained 29.3 lane miles per full-time equivalent, 29.3. Northern region does 42.2. Central region is at 37. And southeast region is at 35.3. In all cases, we are doing more than 16 or 15 of the 18 western states average with our people. The number of miles of road maintenance for which responsibility is transferred to local governments. In 01, we did 35.2 lane miles of road maintenance responsibility transferred from state to local government. This is an increase from 22.6 last year. These transfers, and I'd like to mention who they are because they're deserving of some comment. They include Fairbanks Trainer Gate Road, Nome City Streets, Kotzebue 3rd Avenue, Haynes Porcupine Road, Juneau Point Louisa Spur, and 2 miles of the Glacier Highway. And in the Matsu Borough, West Matanuska Spur, Jensen Road, Church Street, 4 Mile Road, Willow Creek Parkway, Collier Road, Spillane Spur, Edgerton Park Road, Cottle Loop, Lakeview Circle, Rue Road, Crystal Lake Road, Disca Landing Road, and Willow Station Road. This program is starting to work, and the cooperations from the boroughs and municipalities that I've mentioned above, I think is to be commended. And I wish we could do this more across the state. But this has really worked well. They've got a good road out of it, and we've taken some of these smaller roads out of the system of state maintenance. 33, whether the department fully implements the maintenance management system statewide by June 30th, 2003. I think in previous testimony, I said we were doing this. I cautioned that I was afraid that we did not want to end up with a complicated system that cost us a fortune. We do have a system that we've selected. We've got a consultant hired, and we are moving on to working this system out. We have also hired a project manager on the 1st of May and are starting the software. The system will be deployed statewide by September 30th, 2003. And I think it's a good system. 34, whether the department maintains the pavement condition index PCI at 70 for runways and 60 for taxiways and aprons at every applicable world airports 99% of the time. This is one that is a little confusing and I'm sure don't make much sense. But anyway, the percentages boil down to 48% in central region, 51% in northern region, and 96% in southeast region. Now, the problem with this performance measure is that, to give you an example, Yakutat runway right now has a rating of 50. There is nothing we can do to increase that rating until Yakutat is rebuilt. So as soon as airports are rebuilt, their rating goes up. I think we're going to look at this measure and see if we can't come up with something that makes a little more sense, because we ought to be looking at what we've got ahead of us to construct rather than a pavement index that's entirely dependent on whether or not you build an you resurface the airport. And by the way, the northern numbers I gave you, which were fairly low, did not include the airports at Nome and Gamble because we have not been out to survey them since we did the work last summer. 35, whether the department completes the environmental impact phase of the Ketchikan Airport Access Project by December 31, 2001. And work on the draft EIS continues. We have come up with a preferred alternative, which we have presented to the city of Ketchikan. We have about a three-month delay, and this was due to the extensive amount of work we had to do with the cruise ship industry to figure out what cruise ships we could pass under what bridges and where. So we're about 3 months behind on that, and I see it probably will not gain the 3 months back, but again, 3 months on a EIS of that size is a pretty sizable endeavor. The alternative that we have in draft recommended is about $190 million facility. The percentage of private maintenance contracts at non-certified airports compared to the total number of non-certified airports. And we have 191 non-certified airports. We have 134 of the 191 contracted out. That equals about 70%. Most of the ones that are maintained by DOT, which is 57, are located next to our highways. And we believe our highway crews are pretty cost-effective at maintaining these airports, and I really don't see that changing. I think if we can handle it next to the highway, it's better than contracting it out. 37, whether the department maintains a 100% pass level of annual federal airport certification inspections or response and safety standards set out in federal aviation regulations. The FAA inspects all of our certified airports once a year, and I'm pleased to tell you that 100% of our airports pass their certification inspection with no major discrepancies. 38, the annual increase or decrease expressed as a percentage in cargo landings at the international airports measured on a three-year rolling average. Ted Stevens, Anchorage International Airport, continues to experience a pretty vibrant cargo business that's vital, I think, to this state. The landings showed a growth weight of 4.3%. The rolling average is still showing a growth rate of about 8.4%. The 8.4 is a lot higher because the growth weight was higher in past years. Fairbanks has a three-year rolling average of about 12%. And this 12% is a little, is not the true story, because this year we had one small cargo airline that had not ever been reporting. So all of a sudden they started reporting and it jumped the percentage up. But to sum it up, both of our airports are growing, I think, satisfactorily. 39, whether the department completes the Gateway Alaska Terminal Development Project by September 1, 2004, and we do expect to complete the project by the end of 2004. However, we are redesigning, even though it's out on contract, the new terminal to include the additional security measures which have been in place by the 9/11 incident. Impact of these changes to schedule is not really known at this time. But it's a heck of a lot easier and less expensive for us to do these changes and have the contractor do it by change order rather than do it a year from now or 2 years from now by jackhammer. And that's really what we're talking about. So we are going to get that fixed up. I don't see major problems with this, but it will be some expense. I think there'll be some more blast walls put in. I think that we're going to have to make some rooms bigger to handle the equipment to check bags. The equipment that the airlines are going to be bringing in, so there will be some changes. 40, the percentage of airports that have Federal Aviation Administration approved airport layout plans. Central region has 72% approved. That's 79 out of 109. Southeast has 100%, and northern region has 89%. We are advancing on those. Those are rather difficult to turn out, but we are making progress. 41, the percentage of time that a marine highway vessel departs on time. Our goal was 75.1%. Our FY01, we had a 79% on departure rate, up from 77% last year. The net revenue per rider mile divided by the operational cost per rider mile for the marine highway. The ratio of the marine highway revenue per rider mile to cost was 0.48 for 01. This is a decrease from last year's figure of 0.51 and a drop of about 6.5%. This was caused by fuel price increases of 30% between FY00 and 01, which drove the cost of the per rider mile up 9.5%. So actually, we would have, if fuel had stayed the same cost, we would have gained about 3% on that performance measure. Since then, we've increased some of our fares, and fuel prices have decreased slightly, so hopefully this trend will change. The total ridership, including passengers and vehicles, compared to the five-year ridership average. The five-year ridership average for passengers have been around 360,000, for vehicles about 102,000. As we expected, due to the reduced operating weeks and the Columbia being offline for this summer, ridership for both passengers and vehicles decreased. Passenger ridership went down 5.5% to 340,000, and vehicles decreased 4.4% to around 98,000. The average onboard review per passenger, including cabin occupancy, food, beverage, and other source of revenue, this is how much we sell to people when they're on. OO, people bought $20.89 worth of goods. And FY01, mainly food, FY01, it went up to $21.19, which is really pretty good when you consider how long the Columbia was out due to the fire, because a lot of those folks on the long haul route that the Columbia runs eat a lot. Our last one is the percentage of persons served by the Alaska Marine Highway System who are satisfied customers. The University of Alaska performed an independent analysis of all of our onboard customer comment cards, and our overall rating, very good to excellent, increased from last year's 75% to this year's 83%. And this completes my specific comments on these measures. In summary, I'd like to give a few thanks here. I'd like to thank the FHWA for allowing us to use 30-plus million of our federal dollars for maintenance work. That's made a tremendous difference. Our roads, in my opinion, are in better shape than they've ever been in. We're bringing to construction this year an increased federal highway and aviation program, which includes special funding appropriated last year for the Dalton Highway and the Glen Parks Interchange. That was $80 million extra. It'll be under both of those. The $80 million has taken us 1 year to commit. We just received an additional $15 million in this year's program for the Seward Highway Bird Creek Safety Project. We're going to move out away from those avalanches. During 2002, we will continue to improve the quality, cost, and effectiveness of all of our programs, but we're going to concentrate a lot on safety and security. We are emphasizing this year safety within DOT, and we're doing this in an attempt to reduce our workmen's compensation costs and to provide our people as safe a working environment as we possibly can. We'll also be concentrating on positioning ourselves, and this will be me primarily, for the reauthorization of T21 in 2003. This important authorization bill will set the amount of federal highway funding Alaska gets for the next 5 or 6 years. To give you an idea of the stakes, there'll be $200 billion up for grabs in that authorization bill. And we need to ensure that Alaska's problems are recognized by the people who are working on that and that we stay well represented. 2001, I think, was a good year, like I said, for DOT. The employees of DOT are doing a great job, and I can't really compliment them enough. It's a pleasure to be their commissioner. I also want to thank the House for its 7-1 vote in support of Garvey bonds. This is a top priority of the department, and I still feel that we need to get these to get some of the big project rolling. You know, I also believe, and I'm old school, and I don't know much about education. I don't want to answer any questions on education, but I was a believer in report cards, and so we went ahead and prepared a DOT report card. And I reviewed this report card, and I gave ourselves a B+. And I would hope when you look at the grade card that you would agree with that grade. Could you pass the report cards out?
Behind door number 3.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and I'd be happy to answer any question that you have.
A comment and a question. After listening to Senator Stevens discuss the obesity issue, with time, it seems we might have some state savings by just not feeding those ferry passengers. But the question I have is with Alaskans valuing local control so highly, it would just seem increasingly to make more sense to have state roads within municipalities, the responsibility of those municipalities, and you indicated some progress there. What could we do to encourage further progress in that area?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bundy, I think the thing the municipalities fear is inheriting a burden upon themselves of where they have to support the payment for all the maintenance for those roads. And they go back to the revenue sharing business of where I think at one time they were up to something like $2,000 a lane mile. It came down over the years, $1,200, $1,500, and then on back down. I think it's about $500 a lane mile. I think an increase in the revenue sharing for the highway maintenance side up to closer to the level that's authorized by statute would sure give the municipalities an incentive, more of an incentive, to take those over. Because right now, to be frankly honest with you, other than getting a good road that don't need maintenance for X number of years, maybe 6 or 8, every one of these people that have taken one of these roads have bought into a future maintenance cost that is not being reimbursed, you know, and not even close by the state. So that, to me, would probably increase their wanting to take over a road if that number was higher.
Representative Hudson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, good report, might add. Looking at just the picture that we're looking at, after 911, we've heard Senator Stevens say time and again that, you know, things are going to change up in here. You're not going to get all the federal money that you had in the past. A lot of projects are probably not, you know, we've had a lot of really good luck, if you will, because of the healthy economy nationally. What do you project to be the level of federal funding, and will there be any increases in state match, if it's an increase that you can see?
Well, the level of federal funding really depends on two things. One, the size of the trust fund. Because the federal highway funding, in deference to a lot of other funds that come to the federal government, is tax money that people have paid in for specific things, such as gas, tires, and all of this. And it goes into this trust fund. And what T21 did, it said, Mr. Appropriator in Congress, you